Welcome to the Big Beatles Sort Out. In the first series, I, author and musician Gary Abbott, ranked all the Beatles' core catalogue releases with the help of my Beatles expert brother Paul. In series 2, we worked our way through an assortment of added Beatles goodies, such as Live at the BBC, the anthology series and the movies. And now for series 3, we are looking at all the post-Beatles singles released in the decade following their breakup. As with series 1, we will take 5 songs in random order each week and score them for music, production and lyrics to find the best post-Beatles Beatles hits. Thanks for joining us as we try and sort out the Beatles. Welcome to series 3, episode 16, and welcome, Paul.
Good. I can always do that, don't I? I go to say good evening. Good evening to you,
well,
Gary.
Good evening.
Good whenever it is to everyone else.
Good. Quite often 7 in the morning on the way to work.
Yeah, good morning, everyone. I hope you're having a lovely day.
Or, if you're like me, good carrot chopping whilst you're kind of making your dinner.
Is that your podcast space?
That's my podcast time, yeah. That's my time.
Yeah. What do you listen to, Gary?
Me? I mainly listen to Harmontown at the moment because I'm catching up.
You're going back over that, are you?
Well, I'm not going back. I've never listened to it all because I only found out about it after it ended, and there's 5 years of it, and it's quite an interesting. But I also have and do listen to an assortment of independent podcasts as well.
You better.
I do, but I have done quite a lot of Harmontown listening, so I'm trying to kind of like get it done. Because I'm kind of caught in that. What about you, Paul? What are you listening to?
Oh, I have a mix of different things. I have quite a few sort of things like Looks Unfamiliar and things like, well, Comedy Bang Bang I always listen to.
Yes.
And I'm a subscriber to that, which is it's various different weird spin-off things. And basically I troll the podcast player for anything with Paul F. Tompkins on.
Yeah, it's quite a lot because he kind of lives in podcasts, doesn't he?
Very much so.
Yes. He's mentioned quite often in Harmontown, but I don't think he's ever been on it until the point I'm listening to, which is about 2016, 17. Because I think he knows a lot of them, and yes, vice versa. Yeah. Okay. Well, don't forget, you can keep in touch with us at big_sort on Twitter and Instagram, or by email to bigbeatlessortout@gmail.com. And do please drop us a review on whatever platform you are listening on if you can, and like and share our posts. Thanks very much. And as I said before and always say, please check the episode description for links to our various music and other projects, such as my album that came out last week as you're listening to this and is still out. And lots of people have been very nice and gone and listened to it. You can listen to it on that link. Or if you're really adventurous, you could buy yourself a CD version of it and I will post it out to you. And it's got some of my art on it and it has 2 bonus tracks. And it's something you can own and I'll do a lovely handwritten note and to go with it. And that is at garyabbott.bandcamp.com, and there you'll find my album linked. Paul has already... You've got albums that have been linked up there for quite a while now with your tape and...
Recent tape and Shake Your Faith, of course, which has been out, coming up for a year soon.
Blimey, is it? Yeah, gosh.
Yeah.
Gosh. I listened more to your tape because I got your tape and realised that my Walkman wasn't very good. So I found a old one that we had in the 90s, late 80s, a Murphy stereo one, a red one.
Oh, right,
It seems to work quite well, so I'm listening to it on that.
Yeah.
So the thing about selling things in old formats, you do rely on people having the kind of old...
Yeah, I know, it's bonkers. It's mad that we've released a tape in this past year. So
I like it, though.
But I'm glad you've listened to it in tape format, not rather than just the digital tracks.
No, I want to listen to it. I like getting things on vinyl and stuff, but it's hard to release them on there because they're quite a big... investment, isn't it?
But don't get me started.
I did like how this week, because I've been trying to get people to buy my album on CD, that Facebook has decided that I just like dead formats and has started advertising VHS at me, blank videotapes. So that I don't think the day's yet
the
come.
Algorithm strikes back.
Yeah, maybe it's trying to start a new trend. I'm trying to think about bands trying to sell like videos of themselves on VHS as the ultimate kind of dead format. I don't think it'll
Betamax.
Take off. Yeah. So, there's that. Paul, is there anything you want to mention before we get on with the Beatles Day?
No, nothing in particular. I'm just enjoying a very nice glass of alcohol-free Leffe still again this week.
The same one?
Yeah, it's got a bit sort of dusty flavoured. Nothing in particular to mention. We talked about podcasts before. I could have mentioned so many.
There is lots
more than I did. Yeah. But tell you what I have been listening to, and I'm sure nobody needs telling. This is A History of Rock Music in 500 Songs, which is a brilliant, brilliant podcast, and I love it. I can't remember if I've mentioned it before, but I'm just saying it again.
Oh, that's another one for my list. I nearly need to break it, sort out Harmontown so I can start listening to lots of, you know, we know lots of great podcasters, and they're all really good, and they do lots of things, but there's only so much time, isn't there? So that's another one from a list. Brilliant. Okay. Right then. Well, let's do an On This Beatles Day, which is the 13th of February.
Yes, and I've chosen the 13th of February, 1972.
Ooh, it's in the decade.
So a 70s one. Yeah, relevant. And it's Wings live at Newcastle University.
Which Newcastle?
North, not the Midlands.
Not the one near me. Okay.
So I've chosen this partly because it's on the date and it's in the 70s, but also because I have been reading the very excellent book, The McCartney Legacy, Volume 1, 1969 to 1973. Mm-hmm. By Alan Cosin and Adrian Sinclair, which is a very big, thick book looking at McCartney's work in this period in detail. So I've just read all about the Wings University tour.
Right.
So this is basically, this gig at the 13th of February in Newcastle was the fourth date of the first Wings tour, which is the one where they basically stick some equipment in a van, stick them in a minibus. Yeah. And just rock up to universities and basically say, can we play this evening?
Yeah.
And
why not?
Which is a bonkers way to go about things.
It is.
You know, completely bonkers.
Am I right? A little I know from that period is that he kind of like self-imposed this feeling on himself, like no one would take him seriously, even though he was Paul McCartney. He is Paul McCartney. Like he had to kind of prove himself all over again.
Yeah, to himself more than anyone else, really. And so he's got this band together and he decides to take them out and they go on, they do a few little dates and, you know, it doesn't go in entirely to plan because, like, they're trying to keep away from the press. So they turn up, they play Nottingham first, they get to Leeds, but it turns out someone's found out and alerted the press. So they sort of just go away.
Right, they just drive past.
Yeah, they basically go, nope. And so they go on and they do York and they play at in Hull as well.
Mm.
Where apparently there was the mess they caused in the hotel led to a very angry hotelier confronting them and Paul hitting him on the nose or bopping him on the nose with his elbow or something.
Bopping him on the nose?
Yeah.
I'm trying to really imagine that manoeuvre in a conversation with another adult. I'll just give you a little bop on the nose of my elbow.
Yeah. Okay. So they head off north then, and on the way up to Newcastle, they stop in Scarborough.
Oh, okay.
Where we grew up.
Where I was born.
Indeed. They stay at the Prince of Wales Hotel in Scarborough, and it's, you know, February in Scarborough.
No, lovely.
Mmm, bracing.
Mm.
Everything's shut. Yeah. But then they head up to Durham, but Durham can't host them because their stage is set up for a production.
Yeah.
So they've got nowhere to put them on. And they go up to Newcastle, and it's the weekend, and it's like, well, everywhere's shut. All the buildings at the university are shut.
No, because it's
the weekend.
Don't they have unions on it? Things at the weekends, or
well, if they had, they would probably have had stuff in there already.
Yeah.
But what they did find out was there's like a student halls that had a performance space.
Okay.
So they go and they play in one of these student halls, and that's their gig on the 13th of February, 1972. I mean, this is they've got like Give Ireland Back to the Irish in the set list because they sort of rushed that single out.
Yeah.
In the previous fortnight in response to the Bloody Sunday stuff. And, you know, so they've got this quite short set of some Wings stuff and that's all relatively new. Some of it's unrecorded, like they're doing My Love long before they've recorded it.
Okay.
And ending with Long Tall Sally, which is something they sort of did for most of Wings, I think. But,
McCartney,
it's just interesting.
Harking back to his kind of training there, isn't it, really?
Yeah, it's like we haven't got enough stuff in the set, so we better do a couple of rockers, things like that. So yeah, Blue Moon of Kentucky's in there as well. You know, those sorts of things that you could jam out easily. But yeah, that's it. That's what he was doing. He was in Newcastle University or in one of the halls of residence doing a gig on the 13th of February 1972.
Yeah.
Yes. And anyway, again, I recommend the McCartney Legacy book. If I've got one complaint about it, yeah. No, I've got two complaints about it, which Ooh. Sounds very churlish, because okay. it is absolutely brilliant. One, it hasn't got an index,
oh.
which makes me looking up specific songs for the purposes of this.
Hard.
Makes it quite difficult.
Mm.
I don't know why that. What decision that was. And two, the font, which has got footnotes. So the font used for the little bullet for the footnotes is so small, it looks like just a tiny little ink mark on the page.
Okay.
And sometimes you don't even notice where the link on the main text to the footnote is, because it's printed this teeny tiny little bullet point to link you to the footnote, where you need a nice big asterisk.
Well, there we go. There's some technical publishing points there for them to take away and think about.
Yes, they should have asked me first. They should have consulted on reference point bullet size things.
But the content and the construction...
Fantastic. Absolutely brilliant.
That's what I'm sure they're mostly interested
in. A very necessary bit of McCartney scholarship.
Very good. Well, again, another one to put to the pile of the very big pile of books I've got to read.
Very big
well.
Book on a very big pile.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. Well, let's stick with the McCartney theme and let's go on to our first song. Listen to What the Man Said. Paul McCartney and Wings.
Soldier boy kisses girl, leaves behind a tragic world. But he won't mind, he's in love and he says love is fine.
Listen to What the Man Said, Paul.
Which man?
The man?
Well, yeah, well, that's a question we need to interrogate during the lyrics discussion, don't we? Yeah. So, Listen to What the Man Said by Wings, with Lovin' Song on the B-side.
Oh, we like that.
Came out very early and has been quite high up, hasn't it, in the charts?
Lovin' Song's, So, this is the A-side.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it comes out on the 16th of May 1975, gets to number 6 in the charts for 8 weeks. It gets to number 1 in America.
Okay.
It's out on Capitol, and it's from the Venus and Mars sessions. And it's recorded on the 31st of January 1975, a date in February as well, at Sea Saint Studios in New Orleans. And... yeah, then there's some overdubs done in LA in March. So this is one of Wings' out-of-the-country albums, where they're out somewhere else, in this case, New Orleans.
Okay.
Paul and Linda co-credit on the writing, McCartney production. And I think, with this song, is if you think about solo McCartney and how a lot of people perceive him...
Yeah.
It's this song.
You can put it in, or wrap it in a bow and say...
Wrap it all up in this song.
Said. Yeah, it's... If this was it, and there wasn't other shades, it might not be for everybody. Who knows? Well, we'll find that out, won't we? But it also reminds me of The Girl Is Mine.
It's heading that way.
It's heading into that kind of oeuvre. Yeah. I mean, I'm really, I suppose that's the nearest I can really do to give it a genre, because I'm really struggling more than I normally do anyway to identify what genre this is. Because, I mean, it has a non-stop McCartney kind of bass bounce almost all the way through. They can do, 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 all the way through it. The kind of first to the fifth. And puts it on the very chirpy side of his style. You know, chirpy, middly, roady, poppy. It's definitely not rock and roll.
No, it's not. This version of Wings, you know, is not the hard rocking one that was on the tour that we were just talking about.
No, and it's not quite.
Or certainly, this material isn't that sort of stuff.
Certainly not. And it's not R&B though. He's singing it in a kind of R&B and in rate instrumentations, giving it a bit of a like. This is maybe a bit of R&B and soul or kind of stuff, but it's not.
Well, yeah, that's the New Orleans thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not. But it's not though, isn't it? It's not. Quite that. It's I can't imagine anyone else singing it. Like, I guess it's kind of more pop than anything, because it's got the big cheesy saxophone over it.
It's commercial pop, which
obviously
McCartney can do. Yeah. He can do it brilliantly, but actually,
do you his want
best
him to?
His best stuff doesn't sound like this.
No, it doesn't.
In my opinion.
No, in my opinion too. I mean, also the constant doom doom boom gives it a kind of Bavarian umpire feel as well.
I think I would have preferred that.
Yeah, they should have made it like
they should have
tuba.
Done like a Thrillington version where it was just like done in a different style.
It's strange. Yeah, but, and you know, so it is a bit of a kind of, it is McCartney being commercial, which is a strange style all of its own. We have that kind of guitar riff that seems to be the main hook, the do-no-no-no-no-no-no, which, you know, which, that seems to be more of a hook than any of the vocal lines. Although the vocal's very cleanly sang and is kind of, he's using his very poppy voice as well, his smooth voice, which is what makes me think of The Girl Is Mine, is he's singing it in his kind of, I mean, I can understand how this is the B-side to... I've already
forgotten. A-side.
Sorry, this is the A-side, and the B-side is...
Loving Song.
Oh, no, actually, I can't know. I was thinking more of his ballad that we've done with Wings.
My Love.
He's kind of got his soul voice on, is what I'm trying to say, basically. But yeah, but it's not really that strong a melody in this, so it just kind of follows the chord changes. And the listen to the man said chorus bits, I think that's the chorus bits, aren't that much different from the verses. And it keeps bouncing back to that riff. And then we have an instrumental C-section with the kind of sax and the electric piano going full on.
Yeah, so the instruments on this, you've got the core of Wings, Paul, Linda and Denny Lane.
Mm.
And you've now got Jimmy McCulloch and Joe English as the extra guitarist and drummer.
Right.
But you also have some guest artists on this. And so as far as we can tell from what I've read and researched is he struggled to get a version of this done in the studio that he liked. But to be honest, you read about his stuff. Thank you, the McCartney Legacy book again. Mm. So often he would struggle and he'd put stuff down and he just couldn't get it the way he wanted it, or it wasn't like they managed it in rehearsal and he couldn't get that. And so they spend a lot of time going back to things and back to things and back to things. And that seems to have been the case with this one as well. Trying to get the song to work. And so what happens is, if someone like Dave Mason, the guitarist, happens to be around, just by chance, he's like, come on in and play.
Just to
so
see
you get Dave Mason, who played with Traffic, comes in and plays a bit of guitar. Then it's also like, well, what else? We need saxophone. Oh, Tom Scott lives near here.
Yeah.
You know, we've talked about Tom Scott quite a bit with George Harrison and things like that.
Mm.
So that saxophone's all Tom Scott, and apparently it's like first take noodling.
Right.
You know. Because Tom Scott's brilliant.
Yeah, he can just,
he can do that. And then he's sort of getting the strings on top of it, and it feels very, like...
overworked, maybe.
It's a bauble. It feels like a bauble to me, you know. It's all shiny, but it's hollow.
okay. Shiny, hollow. Yeah. It reminds me of The Girl Is Mine, but without the really strong melody hook, and obviously the kind of huge duet type of opportunity. So I find, which, you know, it's very, very pop. And I find the repeated riff a bit tedious after a while. I get fed up of listening to It's and again, like last week with Getting Closer, I prefer the outro in the last 30 seconds to the rest of it. I think the last... It has
the wonder of it all, baby.
Yeah, it's kind of finds its feet just as it's finishing. Yeah, I don't think I like this one much. I'm going to give it... but, you know, it's not... It's not bad music, it's just not great. So I'm going to give it 64 for music.
Yeah, I'm afraid it's not one for me.
No. If it was all like this, you'd have gone, oh, okay. But it, like you say, I think the shame of it is that people won't know that it isn't all like this if they've only heard some
He got of accused of so much lightweight stuff that wasn't lightweight.
Yeah.
When this is there.
Yeah, exactly.
But it gets to number 6. So, and it's a US number one. It's
can't complain.
People wanted that sort of stuff and they liked it.
Yeah. I mean, it was the 70s, which is a strange time. Okay, well, let's move on to production then. I mean, I don't mind the production so much. I mean, I'm always a bit cautious of sax and electric piano kind of going a bit smaltzy over everything. But then that's if they're going after a soft pop rock, or soft pop mainly, vibe, that's what they're going for, isn't it? There's lots of trebly reverb on the guitar riffs and, you know, that gives it that kind of soft feel as well. But it's what they wanted to do, so, yeah. You know, and I like the strings towards the end, like I said. They come in and they sound okay. Yeah, do you have any production notes?
No, I've just... It's very straight ahead and commercial. It's a very commercial sound. The production that's needed for a hit song. And it works because it becomes a hit song.
Yeah, so you can't say they didn't. Yeah.
Like, they've got funny little moments in there, like the Linda doing the kissing noise on after the line about the soldier boy kisses girl, and that's pushed right up in the mix. So you've got, like, the sort of kissy noise.
Oh, I didn't catch that.
How did you not miss... It's
I think
so
I may have
loud.
Been hypnotised at that point by the... In fact, if you take those six notes, or whatever it is, you could can imagine them as a kind of a soap opera theme, couldn't
well,
you?
Well, yeah. But yeah, I mean, there's a live version of this which you can hear off the Wings Over America album.
Mm.
And it sort of, to me, feels like the song's more present in the live version because it's sort of piano-led.
Oh, okay.
I mean, it's very similar, but because you can hear him playing it as a song, whereas here, this feels like a studio construct, and I don't particularly like it. But it's constructed very professionally, very commercially.
And they succeeded. I'm going to give it 72 for production.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So lyrics then. Lyrics. So as we said at the top, who is the man in this particular situation? I can't quite figure out if you want to listen to what the man said or not.
Because the man is usually shorthand for the powers that be. You don't want to be listening to the man. The man's trying to keep you down.
But it's unclear because we have him saying, "Oh yes, indeed, we know that people will find a way to go, no matter what the man said." Which seems to be no matter what the man says, we will find a way to. That seems to be the man. But then mostly the man's saying nice things because he says, "For all we know, our love will grow." That's what the man said. Oh, well, we like the man now. Well, the man's saying our love will grow. So it's the man is an inconsistent man.
Well, would you like to hear what Paul McCartney thinks?
Have you got him there with you?
Yeah, sorry. I should have put him on the mic earlier, shouldn't I, really? He's just been sitting here listening to me dismissing his songs. Very patient. No, he does this thing sometimes where you can put a question into his website, like his fan website, and he'll pick one out randomly and answer it.
Right.
And it was in 2016 when someone said, "Listen to what the man said is a wonderful song," this person asked.
Mm.
"Who is the man someone should listen to?" And so they say, "To find out Paul's answer, we spoke with him before he went back out on the road for his recent one-on-one North American leg. He answered, 'Thank you for your question, Lewis. There are many answers to who is the man. In one way, you could say the man would be as the expression, you're the man.'" So, right. "Another way to look at it is that every religion has a leader who they consider to be the man, and his teachings are generally very positive. I like the idea that I leave it to the people to decide in their minds who the man is."
So, no,
make it up yourself.
There is no man.
It's the man in the high castle.
Okay. So there isn't really a man, and the words do kind of go between man good. I mean, it's mainly all about...
There's basically two nice verses things here and an outro. Yeah, they repeat the second verse three times to really ram it home.
But yeah, so yeah. It is lovely pop lyrics. Lovely, should I say, pop lyrics, but not the most interesting. I'm going to give them 55. So it gives it 63.7 overall.
Mm.
Okay, let's move on to the next one, which is Imagine, John Lennon. Imagine all the people
living life in peace. You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not.
Imagine, John Lennon, Paul.
I often do. Mm. I often do. Well, it had to happen, didn't it? It had to come out at some point.
Yeah.
This is
about one I'm not really familiar with, this one, to be honest.
Yes, it's a little obscure single put out by John.
B-sides, I think.
Yeah. Right. Let's get into this here.
Okay.
So this is Imagine by John Lennon. A single which comes out in... the UK on the 24th of October 1975.
Okay.
Having been a single in America in 1971.
Okay. Oh, I didn't know this.
So this is interesting. Its reputation is huge. Because you obviously have the song on the album Imagine from way back when.
Yeah.
You know, the early 70s. But in the UK, it doesn't come out as a single until 1975.
Okay.
And in fact, on the cover of the UK single, John Lennon, Imagine, and it's got a picture of John in a nice, in his big floppy hat and a nice chunky jumper.
Yeah.
And it says, and it's a little sort of flash on the corner of the thing, says, released as a single for the first time in the UK. So its reputation was already huge as a song.
Yeah.
And it had already become sort of the Lennon thing that people associated, you know, with him.
Mm.
It's credited to originally to the John Lennon Plastic Ono band with the Flux Fiddlers, which is the name they gave to the string section.
Right.
And this issue in the UK has Working Class Hero on the B-side, and it's essentially, it's tied into Shaved Fish, which was a compilation album
yeah.
that came out. So it's a single to go with that.
Okay, and is it just exactly the same version? That
yeah, it is.
One?
Yeah,
it's just
absolutely
reissued, but with a new B-side, and
or issued in the UK for the first time. Yeah. Yeah, as the I mean, in terms of having to pick a lead single to advertise a compilation,
well, exactly. Yeah, it's a compilation, yeah. So it makes sense, doesn't it?
But let's have a look at this. It's charting history.
Okay,
so it actually gets to number 6 on its initial release.
Okay,
it spends 11 weeks in the charts. Obviously, after his death, it re-enters the charts, getting to number 1.
Okay.
And it's in the charts for 13 weeks. And then over the turning of the millennium, 1999 into 2000, in case anyone doesn't know what that means, it's in the charts again at number 3.
Okay.
What spends was, 11 weeks there. And so with a couple
that,
of...
what was that one? Why was that? Did it appear on an advert or something? Or did it...
I don't know. Do you know what? I honestly don't know. Someone will tell us.
Yeah.
But yeah... So with that and a couple of other occasions,
yeah,
it spent like 42 weeks in the charts over since then and now.
And so, plus all, and that's the UK. It had already got to number one in the US in 1971.
Yeah,
yeah,
and it's also it was also out for, got 5 weeks in the charts when it was issued as a double A side with Jealous Guy at some point in the late 80s.
Right.
So, yeah, it's a hit.
Yeah.
It's a success, but at the time, it's number 6. You know, it's not like people went, oh, we've been waiting for the buy this in the UK.
Yeah.
The mid-70s, Imagine was probably not what people wanted. I don't know. It's
well,
it's
as you say, they already had it. If they
and,
were,
yeah.
They,
yeah,
they already had it on an album, so...
Yeah.
You know, it must cut out some of the audience when that's the case.
It wasn't new product, whatever no. way, yeah. But in terms of recording, it's recorded on the 27th of May 1971 at Ascot Sound, which is the name given to John's recording studio that he had built in his house at Tittenhurst.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then the strings are added in Record Plant East in New York, written by John, although he always wanted it to be, or he didn't at the time, but later said it should be John and Yoko.
Okay.
It's produced by John and Yoko and Phil Spector.
Right.
And it's just... incredibly, I mean, we could talk about this. You could do a whole podcast series on Imagine,
yeah,
and its impact and people's feelings and thoughts about it. But what I think is amazing about this is that they didn't go nuts.
Mm.
He had a simple song and they kept it simple.
Yeah.
And he trusted in that simplicity. So you've got John on vocal and piano.
Mm-hmm.
You've got Alan White on drums and he's playing very careful drums. Yeah, yeah. He's not underplaying it. He's not overplaying it. It's all right. You've got Klaus on bass.
Yeah.
And that's it for the core of it.
Yeah.
And other than that, it's the string section, the Flux Fiddlers.
The Flux Fiddlers, yeah.
Which is amazing. And it all hinges on the simplicity of those chords and the power of John's voice.
Like, yeah. You've just said it all for me.
Okay, moving on.
That's it. Yeah, we could do a whole podcast on it or we could just summarise it succinctly and move on. No, it's exactly really what struck me listening to it specifically for the purpose of critiquing the music is thinking, well, the music is so simple, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, if any of you who are listening play piano, even a little bit, especially chords and things, you'll know how easy this is to play when you know your basic triads. And, you know, you basically bounce between the kind of first in the chord and the third and the fifth in the right hand and play the same chord in the left hand. And you just repeat it as the chords move kind of logically where you want them to in the key. It all kind of effortlessly moves where you'd expect them to. Save perhaps the very poignant introduction of the kind of, it's an E7th that's in there.
Yeah.
Which has that leading third, which makes that sound.
Mad, isn't it, that a chord can be so good. It's just a chord, but in its context in this is brilliant. So I think harmonically, this is a very controlled song. It's quite simple. Mm. But he's doing this C major thing, which then has this C major seventh, which introduces a note, a B natural above the C chord.
Just as it's a passing note. It's like a passing C major seventh.
Yeah, it's a little thing to just make it something that's not, so it's not too much like a seesaw chord thing on the piano. But that little B natural sort of anticipates an E major chord, which is not something you would necessarily go from C major to an E major.
No.
But he does it, and that little beat, that little B natural in the C major seventh, just helps him to make that lovely step change using that E chord. Oh,
it's one of those changes that when you're writing music and you've come up and you find a reason to use something that sounds a bit like this, it never sounds like Imagine, but you think about it because it's like, it's got that C to E seventh thing is something, you know.
Yeah, which enables it then to step up to the F, which is the first chord of that phrase that's coming.
It enables you to break out of a kind of a majory kind of pattern and put it somewhere else for a little while and kind of does it with panache. But and behind it, like you say, a simple bass just plays the root, doesn't do much else, does it, the bass? Strings play the same chord as the piano, but just legato, basically, just...
The orchestration is also credited to John.
Yeah.
It was actually, he wrote the orchestra, or he arranged the strings, and it was actually orchestrated by a guy called Tori Zito.
Okay.
It's John who basically said, I want the strings to go like this.
Yeah. And they're not much off kind of just hitting the, if it was a synth strings, you'd just be holding the chord down. They're not much off that, are they? They're just playing the chord, and they're keeping it sustained for the time that the chord is playing for. That's it, really. And as you say, overall that, and you've got the kit, which is just keeping it simple and tight. And overall that, John sings it perfectly. And that's the thing, isn't it? He nails it. It's the right expression. I mean, this is Lennon's Let It Be or Hey Jude, isn't it? It's questionable.
It's kind of almost beyond all.
Well, that's it. It's questionable as to whether he went further still, because he doesn't just blend his most poignant melody and lyrics. Well, he does blend his most poignant melody with lyrics that are just precisely the right music and epitomise his message, you know. It's, and whereas Hey Jude and Let It Be are very, very, very good songs, you don't feel that they were Paul McCartney's kind of pinnacle of what he was trying to say. Because they're mainly McCartney songs, aren't they, those two?
Yeah.
Whereas this is for Lennon, isn't it? I think.
Yeah, it's a funny one. It must be weird to write a song like this and have it come out so well and be so instantly, reacted to, let's say, because I think a lot of people like to misunderstand.
Yeah.
And they still do. And, but in terms of the music, it's funny that John says, he conceived it in my head. Try that again. Imagine is a song conceived in my head without melody. The first verse came to me very quickly in the form of a childlike street chant. So basically the rhythms of the words, but like imagine, just kids chant.
Yeah, I suppose you can imagine.
And he said, the piano intro I've had hanging around in my head for years, the chords and melody followed naturally from this, and the middle eight was conceived to finish off the song.
Yeah. All right, just like...
Needs it's a song for children, he says, and I understand what he means when he says that.
Yeah.
Simplicity.
It is. It's not flashy or edgy or complex. It's Imagine. And I mean, I was talking to my wife about it, and she was acknowledging it's not something she would listen to, but she can't not acknowledge how good it is, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. Even it's one of those, I think it would be hard for anyone to objectively say this isn't a good song, even if
people do though.
Yeah, they do, because they are then, because that's that they're doing that in opposition to the fact that it is there, isn't it? They are, I mean, that the whole premise of them saying it isn't is because they just want to be different, and they can only do that by the fact that it is. So
yeah,
you know, it's just attention. But anyway, yeah. So I'm going to give it 96 for music.
Yeah. Simple but effective, I think, is the is exactly to describe it. And I think what's also interesting as well, though, is like the choice of the piano sound, because they were very careful about this, because obviously it's associated with this white piano, white grand piano, that it wasn't recorded on.
No, which you is know. The one from the Imagine documentary or film yeah. or whatever it was.
So there's if anyone wants a good walkthrough explanation of this, which I will do very quickly here in a second, but there is a video on YouTube by Andrew Dixon, it was a good presence on Beatles Twitter, talking you through this. But basically, he writes it. He's got this battered little upright piano that he writes songs on in his bedroom at Tittenhurst. You know, absolutely worn to pieces, his piano, but it's his favourite thing to write on. He's got that. Then they try recording in the studio with this Steinway Z piano, which is an a Steinway upright, which is the one that's now in Strawberry Field in Liverpool.
Okay.
So you can go and see it. Then they do try recording it on the white piano, but that's somewhere else in the house, away from the studio. Yeah. So they put the sort of the lines through and the mics, but of course it's in a room that's not acoustically any good.
No.
So they end up going back to the Steinway upright in the studio, and that's the one that it is, which is great because it's tonally, it's a beautiful sound on the piano.
Well, this is interesting because we're already getting into production, and I think we're going to have a slight... I do think the sound's good, but I don't know if the reverb's great. And actually, I just accept it, and I don't mind. And it's not. If I'm trying to find anything to pick up on it, basically.
Yeah.
And for me, I can imagine a version where it was slightly less muddy in the reverb. The sound of the piano is good, but it's being allowed to ring out, isn't it? He's got his foot firmly down on the reverb pedal.
Yeah.
And I think that's. There's a bit of tape hiss.
Something's been done to the piano. This is what I don't get. So we're on to production now, clearly. And remember, we've got the words Phil Spector hanging in the air here as well. But if you listen to... So the start of the song, the opening chords,
it's in
the famous
center,
bit, is right... Yeah, it's right in the middle, in the centre. And then the moment the voice comes in, the piano is suddenly to your left and your right.
Yeah.
Which is a strange way to present a piano sonically.
Yeah.
Because it's not like it's a solo piano piece with a big wide range of low notes and high notes where you would perhaps try and you'd use microphones to try and have that spread of that piano placed.
Yeah.
In so the listener's experiencing that.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know exactly what they've done here, whether it's they've put a couple of mics on it and then hard panned it, but because it's all in a very low register, it sounds a bit odd.
Yeah.
Rather than being left hand, right hand, low, high, it's all in a quite low register. Yeah, I don't know. It's interesting, though.
I was playing it at the piano at our mum's house, and I realised it's not on middle C, is it?
It's the octave down.
Yeah, it's the octave down. When it first starts, when you're listening closely on headphones, there's quite a lot of tape hiss, like they've had to turn up the gain quite a lot. And then it settles down as everything, it goes once everything's in with it. And also, that means. There's quite a lot of resonance still ringing in the air from the kind of notes that are being played it's fine because they all play into each other, so they don't sound bad. But I can imagine, he says, being the operative word, I can imagine them having cleaned up the piano or got a different piano sound slightly and it not making it any worse and maybe even making it slightly clearer, but it's not enough to kind of really affect it. But that's the only thing I can think. The rest of it, the voice joins in with the perfect amount of effect on it to complement his style, which is why he goes for that, isn't it? When he gets it right, it works really well. When he's not, he's kind of overly done, but it just accentuates his tone. The bass is really subtle and the strings are not overbearing but doing their job. I mean, it's the same as the playing. The recording of it is the same as the playing, isn't it? The kit is clean and precise and it cuts through the reverb too. So that kind of grounds it a little bit. And once everything's going, that piano reverby noise, which is a bit overbearing and hissy and a bit too much in the intro, starts to create a nice backdrop texture to it all eventually. Just not so much when I think it's exposed in that full kind of centre at the beginning. I guess this hasn't really been remixed. Has it been remixed much?
There's all those different versions. There's now an ultimate version. And of course, Imagine has come out as a super big box set.
Right.
So you can hear like the strings isolated. You can hear the pure take 10, which is the master take that it was built on.
Okay.
On its own. And there's like even like what they call a documentary mix, which is audio footage of right. them talking about it, you know, as it goes through its stages, which is about 6-7 minutes long, which is worth listening to.
Oh, cool.
That's all on never like, deep, the streaming services and things.
Never deep dive into it that much.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I'm glad they didn't produce it differently, though, even if, you know, because obviously whatever they did, they ended up with, imagine, you know, maybe the piano could be a bit clearer for my ears, but it needed no more, no less, really. I'm going to give it 90 for production.
Mm-hmm.
Which leaves us with just, just the lyrics, though. Oh, you nearly had a full house. And then no, again, lyrics reflect everything else. Such a simple concept. And it's funny you're saying about that children chant, because, yeah, it's imagine this, imagine that. It's kind of, it's lyrics by formula almost, in that, you know, once you've got that shape, you just start filling in the blanks, don't you?
Yeah, but I think you have to keep in mind, so something Yoko did was a book called Grapefruit.
Yeah.
And that first came out in 1964, which was various, what, the sort of instruction poems.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, so everyone will know them. It featured things such as Cloud Piece, which is, in its entirety, imagine the... Try and get it right.
Okay.
Cloud Piece. Imagine the clouds dripping. Dig a hole in your garden to put them in. 1963, spring. So that's an imagine instruction.
Yeah.
And also a thing called Tuna Fish Sandwich Piece. Imagine 1,000 suns in the sky at the same time. Let them shine for 1 hour. Then, let them gradually melt into the sky. Make one tuna fish sandwich and eat. 1964, spring. So, that's a massive influence on this song.
Yeah. Of course, yeah. And he's just taken that to the lyric place, hasn't he? You know, that's, he's taken that to the,
yeah,
you know, how can you shape this for a commercial song, because it's intended to be released and bought and is, but also marry it with his message, which is, you know, broadly a message of hope and you know, yeah, and I think this probably is his most distilled version of his message. Imagine everything being better. You know,
well, that's it, and it is. Imagine he's not saying go get rid of your possessions, you know, things like that. Yeah. Which people, that's always the thing that's leveled at him or anyone who uses this for message purposes, which it has been horribly applied to all sorts of things.
Yeah,
if you have imagine no possessions and you're a millionaire, yes, it's understandably people are going to go, well, what about you? You've got money and houses and cars. It's like, well, that's not the point. He's saying imagine no possessions.
Yeah.
You know, this isn't a way of letting him off the hook. That's not the purpose of the song. No. If your cynical response is to go, yeah, but look at you, then you're part of the problem.
Exactly. Well, he's challenging pessimism. He's calling it out for being the kind of progenitor of misery and the status quo. He's simply saying, imagine things not being like that. Can't you even just imagine things being better? Oh, no, things could never be better. The thing is, you know, blah, 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 the way that the market forces, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's like, can't you even just imagine it being better for a lot of people outside of your own sphere of experience? You know, that's all he's saying, isn't it? It's more powerful. Yeah. It's the most powerful. It's more powerful than his direct calls to action, because those do start to become problematic if you start to follow them through logically. But if you start from a foundational kind of urge for things to be better for everybody, then you can work from that, can't you? Whereas if you say revolution, it's like, well, maybe not, you know, you don't know. But
yeah,
I think
it's... I mean, John couldn't even make his mind up about revolution.
No.
So, but this, you there's no arguing with it, really. So, no.
Yeah.
Except, people will have issues with the no religion too. But again, it's not him saying religion is rubbish, there shouldn't be anything.
Yeah.
He's saying, imagine that there wasn't some of these boundaries that exist because of certain people in certain situations and, using religion as an excuse.
Exactly. That's the difference, isn't it? He's not saying, imagine no connection to spirituality, even via a framework of religion. He's saying, imagine no religion, which can be taken as shorthand, but I would have thought for...
God, we're getting very tedious now, Gary.
Or organised religion. I know, well, this is the thing. I mean, this is this.
People know this song.
Well, the thing is, whether it helps anything or not, who knows? But all I can say for me is that songs like this and songs like this with this kind of message have reinforced and inspired actions I've taken or not taken in my life. So when I hear messages like this, I want the same things and I'm reinforced by them. I know I might not be a big social justice warrior or someone who dedicates my life to it. In my little way, I try and align myself with these kind of messages. And so when you hear it and see it reflected in the news or not the news, I meant the media and things like that. Not the news, is the opposite, to be honest. When you hear that the people out there had similar ideas, you feel validated by that and hopefully think, well, actually it is worth being nice. There are people, it's worth it sometimes, isn't it? So I think it has made a difference because it's made a difference to me. So it must have made a difference to lots of other people. So I'm going to give it 100 for lyrics and those people can go and sod off.
Wowzers. I did a snap poll on our Twitter just this afternoon while I was just finalising my notes to just say, do people think that John's Imagine, his version of the song, is it underrated, overrated or rated just right? Goldilocks and the Three Bears. And rated just right comes out. So maybe I'm getting defensive on its behalf.
Yeah.
But the nearest, you know, a third of the respondents did say it was overrated.
Yeah, there's going to be that. It's going to have a lot to do. Everything's subjective at the end of the day, but, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm giving it 100 for Luke's. That gives the song 95.3 overall.
Okay.
Okay, then. So next, I Lie Around, Paul McCartney and Wings. In the country, I will lay my burden down. I lie around. I lie around. I lie around. All over the place. All over the place. I lie around, Paul.
Do you? Indeed, you lazy get.
All over the place, apparently.
All over the place, in bits. Paul McCartney and Wings, I Lie Around, the B-side of Live and Let Die, which is interesting.
It is interesting.
It's got a certain sort of, some bombastic qualities that sort of match it up a little bit, despite the fact that it's a sort of country-ish song. Yeah, so it comes out on the 1st of June 1973. Live and Let Die, being the A-side, this gets to number 9 in the charts. And it's from the sessions for Red Rose Speedway, or even though it's not on the album.
Mm.
Well, it's associated with Red Rose Speedway and that time period, but it's had a really long recording history. So when I talked at that first song about McCartney sometimes not being able to get something over the line in the studio the way he wants it.
Yeah.
This was begun during the Ram sessions in like October 1970.
Okay.
Worked on in January and February in 1971 in these New York recording sessions. And then basically, he just can't get it over the line of those really early recording sessions. So he just ends up revisiting it during the sessions for Red Rose Speedway in September of 1972.
Do you think he ever threw anything away?
Yeah, there's definitely stuff in his archive that he's...
He will never see the light of day. Do you think he still always... I reckon even now he'll probably still go and poke at it now and again and go,
I think so. And if
I can make you work.
And if you look at anything to do with what he puts out in the 70s, you know, stuff has a long gestation period and he does put stuff away and then come back to it when he has different players or different availability or he needs more stuff. Red Rose Speedway was initially going to be a double album and it ends up being... He ends up being told this has to go out as a single album. So he had tons of stuff, of which this was one of the songs, but this ends up as a B-side.
Okay.
And bafflingly, when he first starts recording it, because it's a Paul and Linda McCartney tune, produced by Paul, when he first starts producing it, Denny Lane isn't in Wings. It's not a Wings track. It's Paul doing Ram.
Right.
And then it gets revisited later on when Wings is a thing, and he's like, well, Denny, you can sing it.
Or some of it.
Yeah, most of it. I'm still going to do some stuff in it.
Mm.
And it is 5 minutes long.
Yes.
Although, for a reason we do not know.
Well, is it because half a minute of that is the introduction audio piece of
people? Oh, the audio of the, oh, we're on holiday type in countryside, yeah. Jumping water, lad.
That stuff. And then, yeah. There's something at the end as well. That kind of, I can't remember how it ends. But there's definitely half a minute before there's any music again.
That'd still make it 4.5 minutes long.
Yeah.
Live and Let Die is only 3:10 or something.
It doesn't surprise me sometimes with some of these when you tell that he was having trouble with them. They feel a bit like overworked and things, or kind of, what you can understand why. It's like, well, it's because it doesn't quite settle into anything. But anyway, yeah, this starts with that kind of a good minute or so just getting started. Even after the 30 seconds, you then go into a big overblown, the I Lie Around kind of chorusy vocal thing as a kind of an intro to the song. And then we get into that, finally kind of get into the kind of summertime loungy yet boppy music with kind of horns yawning over it and the bass kind of keeping it up kind of pace wise. Then we have a kind of the chorus bit, which is the I Lie Around bit that was also in the intro. It's kind of got that kind of Little Help From My Friends type of feel to it, but the Joe Cocker version.
Oh, right, yeah, I know what you mean.
And the
yeah.
chorus itself is the words all over the place over a bit of a jam. It kind of ends up in a bit of a jam. I quite like the individual elements, but I'm just not sure they all come together. It's kind of fun in places.
Yeah, I like some of the bombast of it, yeah. But that sort of doesn't make sense in terms of what the song's about.
Yeah.
If it's about anything.
Yeah, and we're getting Paul McCartney only comes in for the last verse. I mean, singing in all the choruses and everything, isn't he? But he kind of, for some reason, just says, I'll take the last verse and I'll knock it up an octave as well. So I think he goes and sings it higher, doesn't he? But I can't quite put my finger on this one again. I don't dislike it, but the words all over the place seem to be apt, kind of, giving it kind of bops freely between bits without a strong sense of structure. It kind of says all over, it's a bit like The Mess again. A song that's called All Over the Place and is a little bit all over the place. But
it's called I Lie Around, but the words are all over the place.
A song which has the words all over the place over the bit where you're like, this is all over the place. But it conjures a kind of nice rock pop, kind of Kinks kind of sounding song with some prog bits in it as well. I kind of quite like bits, but they're just not quite all landing. So I've given it 70.5 for music.
Yeah, it's interesting. It was a long time coming, and then it finished off with him sort of giving Denny Lane something, a sort of vocal spot, and it's odd because it's a song clearly born of wanting to get away to the countryside, which is what he was doing at the start when he first conceived it for the what became the Ram Sessions.
Yeah, production wise, I quite like the sound of it. I mean, that tangle of instruments in there are all coming through well in the gaps. And it could have sounded a bit confused because there's quite a few things going on, isn't there? And it has that clean Wings harmonies and sounds that pull it through. So I've given it 79.5 for production, Paul. Have you got anything else to add to that?
No, nothing particularly. It's got a nice little percussive element that they've come up with in the studio, which is they've added to the drums by someone playing sandpaper block.
Ah, okay.
To give it a little sort of, I can't obviously simulate. I haven't got any sandpaper, but
don't do the hand rubbing. I don't like that sound.
That's my ASMR.
Oh, that's like the opposite. Now, it's quite good. I like the sound of it. It's just the song. I quite like the sound they're going for. They kind of, I get the summertime feel. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So lyrics then. Lyrics. There's not a great deal to the lyrics. I quite like the fact that it was fun while it mattered is a good line. So long, bye-bye, it was fun while it mattered. Because obviously you'd normally think it was fun while it lasted, wouldn't you? And mattered's quite an interesting way to put it.
Again, think about this, post-Beatles.
Yeah.
Getting away to the countryside.
Oh, yeah, because it was actually a lot closer than when it came out. Yeah, so roll along, Wheel of Fortune. As you roll along, I stick around. Furthermore, in the country, I will lay my burden down. And then of course mainly saying I lie around all over the place. It's not quite clear why the lying around is so geographically varied, because it sounds like a song about being lazy, giving up and lying down. But if you're doing it all over the place, you're actually doing quite a lot of moving around, aren't you?
Yeah.
To get from one place to another. I'm going to have a little lie down over here. I'm going to have a little lie down over there. So relaxing. It's just a strange turn of phrase. I lie around all over the place. I mean, it makes sense, but it's also just a strange one. It's not got the succinct theme that would elevate it to a classic little summer or springtime gem, has it? It's okay. No. But it seems I have no choice in the matter. Roll along, Wheel of Fortune. That's the same thing again. I Will Lay My Burden Down is quite a poetic, dramatic type of way to put it, isn't it? Anyway, I don't really think it's okay. 70.5 for lyrics I've given it.
Okay.
Which gives it 73.5 overall.
Right.
Right. So, anything else to say on that, Paul?
No.
Well, then we'll move on. Next, This Guitar Can't Keep From Crying, George Harrison. Found myself out on a limb, but I'm happier than I ever been. But this guitar can't keep from crying. Learn to get up when I fall, can even climb from the stone wall. This guitar can't keep from crying, Paul.
Oh, little guitar. Oh, don't worry, little guitar. It'll be okay. It'll be okay, little guitar.
It's okay. It's stopped now. It's gone to sleep.
Oh, shh. This guitar can't keep from crying. Is it something to do with While My Guitar Gently Weeps, perhaps?
Yes.
Kind of.
I'd say the sequel.
Yes. It's the it's a single that has Maya Love on the B side.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, it comes out on the 6th of February 1976. It did not chart.
Mm.
And it is on the album Extra Texture. Read all about it. Although the album version is apparently longer than the single, but I couldn't find a copy of the single version to check. So it's recorded in April, May in April and May in A&M Studios in LA.
Okay.
Written by George, produced by George. A nice little sort of band lineup of George, Jesse Ed Davis on electric guitar, which is obviously important in this. David Foster on piano and string arranging. Gary Wright playing the ARP strings. And right. Jim Keltner on drums. Good old Jim. George is also playing the ARP bass. So ARP being a brand of synthesizer.
Yes, I picked that up somehow.
Yeah. So we have some very synthy sounds on this. Mm. I don't know whether Gary Wright would have been playing a dedicated one of... So ARP had different synths for different purposes, and they had some multi-purpose ones. But we're talking about compact synths now, not like Moog, big Moogs from the old days.
Mm.
So whether he was playing like a dedicated, the ARP Solina, which was a string synth, or whether it was one of the other ones, we don't know that information.
We just don't know.
But we do know that it's got synths on it because you can't miss them.
Because it starts with bow.
Yeah. So why bow. They didn't just record an actual bass guitar on this, I have no idea.
That's actually not my biggest problem with it, but we'll get on to that. I don't mind the synth bass. Synth bass, very loud toms. Kind of a Frampton-y sounding guitar, but it's not him. But obviously, there's a bit of a guitar, but which has that weird modulation on it. It's some interesting choices to make here.
Yeah, so I mean, it was written in Hawaii in February of 1975, or it started being written in Hawaii in February 1975, because he'd basically just been pummeled by the press over, you know, the Dark Horse tour, and all that stuff, and some of which he sort of brought on himself by perhaps not being more critical about what's happening with his voice and stuff like that. Mm. Part of it was because he had to do that stuff. He had to make money, he had to release records. But like people, especially Rolling Stone, and they're mentioned in the lyrics, were like really digging into him at the time. And so he's getting, from the sounds of it, depressed.
Oh.
And so the guitar that can't keep from crying is obviously just a metaphor for George.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll get on to metaphors and as well later. But, I mean, I think there's, musically, there's a really great underlying chord pattern behind this song with a real kind of epic menace to it, very much akin to Gently Weeps, whilst being its own thing. But it, you know, I think, you know, Out and Out feels like a sequel to it, whilst without being derivative of it. Although it's, well, obviously, I suppose it has to be derivative in a way, but not an imitation of it. It's not much more than one kind of one or two rounds of chords repeated with textures of strings and the synth strings being added and the guitar getting a chance to kind of let loose over the top. And George's doing a great job of the singing here, so his throat is cleared up by this point.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a link that rambles a bit, but it's better when it's kind of the main chords, which it ends up being for the majority of the song. So I think there's the main round of chords, which is the meat of it. I don't mind the synth bass so much, but I just don't know why the drummer has forgotten half of his kit.
Yeah, that's the decision I can't figure out musically. Why they would have?
Yeah.
Why you'd have Jim Keltner there and say, "Don't use your snare.
Just bang a tom in."
And we're going to push it right up in the mix.
Yeah, it's so missing a solid snare, and a bass drum. Because the tom's just the only thing you can really hear, but the snare is like, God, please give me a snare to get the song moving. But we'll talk about that in production, but musically as well, you know, as a decision, it's like, well, why? It's not as accomplished as Gently Weeps, but it's not half bad, I don't think. If not realised as well as it could have been, if they'd just made a few different choices, maybe, with the arrangement and instrumentation. Especially the fact that it's got no blooming beat to kind of make you go, yeah, this is getting going. It's just dong, ding, do, dong. It's just got like a flabby tom just happening every now and again.
Yep.
Don't know what that's about. I've given it 74 for music. What do you think of the music, Paul?
Yeah, I understand all you're saying, basically. I do struggle with the squelchy bass synth.
Yeah.
I've got a theory on that, but I will mention that he re-recorded this, or he did a version of this with Dave Stewart, you know, from the Eurythmics.
Oh, yeah.
In 1992.
Right.
And I found on YouTube today someone's uploaded some studio like camcorder footage of them recording it at the time.
Okay.
You know, and there's all these celebrities around, and it's there's like a point about 14 minutes into this footage where Bob Geldof's asking him if he's heard a certain Neil Young album, and George is like, no, I don't like it. Don't like his playing at all. And he just lays into Neil Young's guitar playing.
Oh, God.
Which is really interesting. But that ended up coming out in 2006 with on a project called Platinum Weird,
right?
That Dave Stewart did, and he got Ringo and Danny Harrison to overdub stuff onto it.
Okay.
So it sounds like they've tried to turn it into an almost While My Guitar-esque version.
Yeah.
And Platinum Weird was this bizarre thing that Dave Stewart and someone called Cara Diaguardi, did, where it was like a sort of hoax that said this was a band from 1974 that...
Yeah.
existed, and here's a documentary about them and stuff like that, but actually yeah. It's Dave Stewart and Cara Diaguardi doing this thing I've never heard of. It's baffling that this song by George, re-recorded in 1992, ends up coming out with Ringo and Danny on it. It's like, weird. In 2006, it's bonkers. But anyway, yeah, but they try and make it more like While My Guitar, I will say.
Weird. Okay, that's very strange. So, you know, on to the production then, we've covered a lot of this in the music because it concerns the synth bass and the drums, but for me, I like the synth bass and what it brings, and with the piano over it and the kind of screamy kind of guitar sounding solos, I like that general feel. It's a point of difference, the synth bass, you know, and the acoustic strumming over it are adding a nice texture, but the drums, what was that about? I just want to hear it kind of cut through. There are songs that can do without a kit or a snare, but not many where you mainly want to hear one tom.
No.
just ringing out in place of one. What was that about? What's your theory? Just weirdness. What was your theory about the synth bass?
My theory about the synth bass is he's gone basically, well, I'm trying to write a song that's clearly a sequel to a certain popular song I did with a band called The Beatles.
Mm.
which was a 60s thing, and so I'm going to do it with a modern instrument instead.
Okay, yeah.
You know, I'm going to make sure it's got a nice modern sound on it, which is a bass done on a different sort of thing, this synth. It's like, yeah, but people are still using bass guitars for a reason.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they sound great.
Yeah, okay. I actually quite like the production, other than everything other than the kit. So I'm going to give it 77 for production.
Right.
Lyrics then. So, I mean, you've just given me some context I didn't have, which is always interesting. So,
Can I read the entirety of what is written in I, Me, Mine?
Go on then, yeah. As long as it's not like 20 pages long.
Yeah, settle down. If people keep on at you long enough, the chances are you will become depressed. We must struggle even though we are all rats and valueless and try to become better human beings, so this song came out.
We're all rats and valueless.
Yeah.
Well, that's a better lyric. That's a good lyric. It's not in the song.
Yeah.
But, he was struggling a bit.
Yeah, Rolling Stone particularly, because, like I say, they get a name check here. You know, what was the name of the article? They did an article. I'm going to have to check what it was called now. The headline of one of the articles where they were writing about the tour was Lumbering in the Material World.
Oh.
And it was not good.
So that's where he says, learn to get up when I fall, can even climb Rolling Stone walls. But this guitar can't keep from crying. Can't understand or deal with hate. Responds much better to love.
Yeah, but, it's a sort of personal admission that of how he's affected by criticism.
Yeah.
You know, he's not saying it washes off, it doesn't matter. He's saying it does matter. I can't help myself feeling the way I feel.
Yeah, yeah.
Can feel quite sad, can be high-strung, sometimes get mad, you know. This is the, you know, George dealing with himself as a human, you know, much as he wishes to have stripped away all ego, which was one of his missions. This is admission that he can't.
In that context, I find
he struggles.
Yeah. I hadn't read it in that context. I'd just listened to it. And because of Guitar Gently Weeps, I was thinking of it through that lens a little bit, you know, as a kind of continuation around this, because obviously you've got crying guitars, which is quite a specific piece of imagery.
Yes.
And I just interpreted it as being whatever his woes or sadnesses, he gets them, he processes them in ways that come out as music, which obviously makes a lot of sense as a songwriter. But that very specific thing, because of the Rolling Stone name check, now you've said that, because he's mentioned the band Rolling Stones in other places, so I never thought about it as being the actual art, the publication. This is him very clearly saying, I'm really sad that you don't like what I'm doing.
It's not very nice,
is it? In that sense, really,
it's quite bold to make that admission, albeit through this imagery of the guitar.
Yeah,
you know, it's very honest.
Yeah. Okay, well, I'm just going to give it its score, which I've given it 76 for lyrics, which gives it 75.8 overall. So then, finally, we have Back Off Boogaloo, Ringo Starr. Back off, Boogaloo, Paul.
Woo! I've been waiting for this for ages. I've got almost nothing to say about it, except I really like it.
Okay.
So this is the A side of the single that featured Blind Man on the B side.
Yeah.
And it gets to number 2 in the charts, so it's a big hit for Ringo. You'll find it now as a bonus track on Goodnight Vienna.
Mm.
Recorded in Apple Studios, written by Ringo and George. But George is uncredited.
Yeah.
Meaning Ringo gets more of the royalties. Produced by George, though. It's got some phenomenal George slide guitar playing on it. I mean, the last song we were talking about has got some great slide guitar playing on it as well, but this one's got a really, really good slide guitar solo in it. And it is literally, it's Ringo coming up with a notion, sitting at his piano, playing really, really heavy basic chords, and just turning it into a fun jam, mad dance time boogie thing.
Yeah, a boogaloo.
Yeah.
Boogaloo-ga-boogie. Yeah, which is kind of interesting. He starts off with a bit of a military march.
Yeah.
Type of snare. Well, it starts off and goes all the way throughout with it, doesn't it? It stays all the way through.
Yeah, and it's only Ringo drumming on this. A lot of Ringo's stuff is either double drums, or you know, he gets someone else to do it. But on this, it's all Ringo.
But that choice of drumming, which is very Ringo drumming, you could tell. You know, if it wasn't Ringo, it'd be doing someone doing a very good Ringo impression, drumming wise. It gives it that big stompy feel, backed up by the kind of piano and bass just hammering the chords out. Just, I say, just hammering at those chords. That feeling it creates with the low end piano is great, and it allows the guitar, like George's guitar, to riff like mad over the top throughout. Sometimes, even having a little bit of harmony riff sections in there.
There is
a little bit of little touch here and there. And then we have Ringo kind of leading a chorus, really, kind of the back off chant. The kind of there's that word menace again, and carries that menace of the kind of order to back off with the driven music. It kind of works hand in hand with that. Like a crowd chanting and advancing, that's what it feels like, because there's a military march. You can imagine a crowd of people stomping up the streets singing this, can't you?
Mm.
And then you just have the little kind of respite slightly of the kind of verse sections, just for a bit of variety to kind of move it along. And Ringo then gets to take the limelight a bit more in those, and he sings them himself mostly, I think. And he does a good job.
Yeah, it's interesting how his vocal is mainly doubled in octaves.
Yeah, he's singing an octave with himself as well, isn't he?
So. Yeah, I think so, which means he must be really stretching his vocal range to do the high one.
Yeah, because
He's comfortably in the lower range.
He's a baritone, isn't he, really, Ringo?
Yes. But I like the way it's doubled up here. So I think that's a good decision, that.
And it, of course, it all culminates in a big old jam, which a song with basically two chords in the chorus can do easily, can't you? It's just two chords. And he's managed to conjure up from those two chords some very interesting music. It's simple but effective, so I'm going to give it 80 for music.
Isn't it interesting? We've used simple but effective for Imagine and Back Off Boogaloo.
Well, they are basically akin, aren't they?
Yeah.
This is Ringo's Imagine.
This should have been the B-side to Imagine.
This is the song that all of those celebrities should have sang during the pandemic.
Yeah, they should have done. Yeah, absolutely.
I think people would have forgiven them then. You know, it would have come off a little less privileged.
Yeah. I mean, it's worth keeping in mind, this was a time when Ringo was hanging out with Mark Bolan a lot.
Yes.
You think of like a glam rock stomp.
Yeah.
And so Mark Bolan was just apparently obsessed with using this word boogaloo. It was just referring to everyone and everything as boogaloo. And so Ringo's like, having sort of spent the evening with, like having a meal with Mark Bolan one night, he's like, oh God, I'll write a song about that.
Yeah.
And also apparently inspired by Jimmy Hill on The Big Match, which was like a football coverage program.
Yeah.
Who used the word tasty, which is why the word tasty's in there.
Well, we'll get onto that in lyrics, Paul.
But yeah, that's just wanted to let you know.
Yeah, well, I'm grateful. But let's do production first. The only thing that really doesn't really annoy me. The only thing that annoys me slightly is this snare rattle from the military march. But it's kind of unavoidable because of the way he's playing it. But it's a little bit too rattly here and there for me.
The problem was, if they'd have tightened that snare up, it would have...
You wouldn't have had the bounce.
It wouldn't have had that big sort of Ringo feel to it. It would have become very militaristic.
Yeah.
Too snappy.
That's the thing. I'm nitpicking. Other than that, this is nicely put together sound-wise. Ringo's voice sits nicely in the wider chorus. You can still tell it's his song, but the backup singing feels like it's in a space where he's literally backed up by them, like a chorus line being mic'd as a whole rather than, you know, it feels like you can imagine him physically, they can imagine the space of him being in a crescent of singers behind him chanting.
Oh, right. Yeah.
You know, and he's singing, he's the one at the front, but he's not necessarily over everything when it's the big kind of unison singing parts. And like you say, when he is doubled with himself as well, that's worked really well. The piano sounds great. And I like there's a lot of metallic twangs in the guitars and the bass. They've got a very new
I didn't tell you the lineup. It's Ringo, vocals, drums, percussion and chorus, obviously. George on slide and acoustic guitars. Gary Wright on piano. Oh, he must have had a great time because he's a good piano player, but it's like, now just hit chords hard. Good old Klaus on bass and apparently saxophone, although I can't really detect the saxophone in there unless it's being used to make a certain sort of effect rather than being a pure sax line. And then you have Madeline Bell, Leslie Duncan and Gene Gilbert on backing vocals as well. So you've got sort of choir backing. Not choir is not quite the word, is it? Crowd.
A very
crowd.
Big sound for a crowd, aren't they? Yeah, cool. I think it all pushes a kind of an industrial-driven sound, you know. It's good.
Yeah.
84 for production, I've given it.
It's lively, but it suits the material.
Yeah, that's it, really. Now you can talk
now
about
we lyrics. Need to, yeah, now we need to dedicate an hour to the lyrics of Back Off Boogaloo.
I mean, you've already said where Boogaloo comes from, so I mean, I was wondering initially if Boogaloo was a bit like a snookeroo and if they were kind of cousins or... But no, it's
a Boogaloo actually makes more sense than snookeroo.
Yeah. I like how it Boogaloo vaguely sounds like it does mean something, like a pet name maybe, but in this instance kind of turn nasty because you're telling them to back off. Nasty pet, back off. The back off line is a good line. I mean, even if he kind of came away from with Boogaloo being a Bolanism, he kind of thought, like, that back off really gives a strong lyric, doesn't it, to lead something with drive.
It's basically go away bad vibes. That's how I read this song.
Yeah. What do you think you're going to do? I got a flash right from the start. Wake up, meathead. Don't pretend that you are dead. Get yourself up off that cart.
That's one of the lines that makes some people think this is about Paul.
Oh, right, yeah.
Because obviously John was...
Paul dead thing, yeah.
Yeah, so obviously there was in the years after the Beatles, it was up to Paul to sort of initiate all the legal stuff to try and extricate himself from Klein and co. And all the arrangements they had. And so obviously John does stuff like how do you sleep and stuff like that. And some people love to think that this is about McCartney.
Yeah.
Like Ringo would be that nasty about it. I know they had their moments like during this period when they weren't like happy mates all the time. But yeah, some that don't pretend that you are deadline. People are like, oh, he must be referring to the Paul is dead rumours and stuff like that. You know, it's not.
No, it's just because it rhymes with head. And then you say about the Jimmy Hill, give me something tasty.
Yep.
Everything you try to do, you know it sure sound wasted.
Dead.
I like you think you're a groove standing there in your wallpaper shoes and your socks that match your eyes. I love that. It's quite a cool line.
It is. It's absolute nonsense.
Yeah, but I like that. I love those socks. They really match your eyes. It'd be better if you kind of said, I like your eyes. They really match your socks. It's you know, your eyes are much the socks. I just like it. I think it's great. I think it kind of generally works as something a bit menacing and forceful with the music. I think it's his best one yet, lyrically. 82.5 for lyrics. I think it's a bit of fun, which gives it 82.2 overall.
It's worth bearing in mind as well that apparently he offered this to Cilla as a single. Like, do you want to do this as a single, Cilla? She's like, what? No.
Oh, Cilla. Too good for Cilla.
Yeah, and there's a music video that they clearly made under the influence of pure laziness, I think, more than anything else. But they just basically got someone dressed up as a Frankenstein's monster.
Right.
Just following him around the grounds of Tittenhurst. And it's very lazily done.
Oh, right.
Yeah. It's, you know, like, and then they dance a bit.
Yeah. Yeah. No storyboard, I imagine. Just run around, dance a bit. Okay, well, an end of another bumper episode because of a couple of big songs in there.
Yeah, there was quite an important one in there, wasn't it?
Yeah. Oh, well, that's done. Let's look first, though, at the ones that haven't got into the chart. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to do a top 20. I'm going to talk about, and then there's the three that didn't make it to the top 20, which are at number 58, Listen to What the Man Said. At number 37, I Lie Around. And at number 29, This Guitar Can't Keep From Crying, being George's one, and the other two being Paul McCartney and Wings. So let's do the top 20 and see where the other two have landed, shall we?
Please do.
At number 20, Yes, I'm Your Angel, Yoko Ono. At number 19, George Harrison, Deep Blue. At number 18, Number 9 Dream, John Lennon. At number 17, My Love, Paul McCartney. At number 16, My Love, George Harrison. At number 15, Back Off Boogaloo, Ringo Starr. At number 14, Power to the People, John Lennon. At number 13, Jet, Paul McCartney. At number 12, John Lennon, Woman. At number 11, John Lennon, Whatever Gets You Through the Night. At number 10, John Lennon, Cold Turkey. At number 9, Kiss Kiss Kiss, Yoko Ono. At number 8, Give Peace a Chance, John Lennon. At number 7, Stand By Me, John Lennon. At number 6, Loving Song, Paul McCartney. At number 5, Band on the Run, Paul McCartney. At number 4, John Lennon, Just Like Starting Over. At number 3, Mullock and Tyre, Paul McCartney. At number 2, Another Day, Paul McCartney. And at number 1, John Lennon, Imagine.
Well, there you go.
We have a title toppler.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Imagine has...
I can't imagine, again, that there's much could knock that off its spot now.
We'll have to see.
Well, we will have to see. Who knows? You might have a sudden and violent reaction to one of the B-sides that we haven't covered yet and just be compelled to make it up. You know?
There's going to be a Yoko one or something, isn't there? I'm just going to go, ooh.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's great, you know. So, yeah, well, we'll find out next week. We'll see, eh? We've still got a good 9 or so episodes left, so we will see you next week for more. This, bye-bye.
Boogaloo!